From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In today's age of Enron, WorldCom, and Wall Street meltdown, the magic of the market, that mantra of the roaring 90s, has lost a little fairy dust. But with all the scandals and sidetracks, the great power of the marketplace goes on. It shrugs, adjusts, and continues. This hour, On Point, we're looking at the markets that make the world go round, successes and failures, and asking what makes markets really work for everyone. We begin with the latest corporate dethroning. Late today, AOL Time Warner's embattled chief operating officer, Robert Pittman, announced he will step down. The conglomerate's once-celebrated internet division, AOL, has failed to meet profit goals, and shares of the media giant have plummeted 70% in the past year. To talk about the troubles at AOL Time Warner, I'm joined by Nikhil Diogan, media and marketing editor at The Wall Street Journal. Good evening and welcome, Nikhil Diogan.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, thanks for being with us. Nikhil Diogan, what does this symbolize, this stepping down of Robert Pittman, who was such an icon of the go-go 90s years?
I think what you're seeing here is essentially a revenge of old media over new media. It's kind of a stunning reverse takeover, if you will. You had America Online, which used its hugely inflated dot-com stock to buy this venerable company, and now you're seeing all the Time Warner executives, tired of the AOL business dragging it down, really seizing control.
The tiring of AOL dragging it down is not just a figure of speech. The share price has fallen by 70%, which means not only have shareholders lost that value, but the executives that came into this from Time Warner have seen their own portfolios shrink incredibly.
Yes, as you can imagine, some of the Time Warner people are very, very happy today because they think they could do a better job of running this. But, you know, to your larger point there, it is kind of the last shovel full of dirt, if you will, on the dot-com digital era.
Does it finally say that this whole partnership was really a kind of mirage, that the notion that this was a marriage of equals was an illusion?
It was an illusion, and you'd have to say that, you know, this merger has turned out to be not what was envisioned by Steve Case, the chairman of AOL, and Jerry Levin, the then chairman of Time Warner, who himself left in December. So you had essentially two architects of the deal, Jerry Levin and Bob Pittman, now leave the company in a matter of a few months.
This deal was on every magazine cover. It was the crown jewel.
It was going to transform our lives, you know.
Yes, it was. And now the chief executive officer, Richard Parsons, is still there looking for a new rationale to justify this continuing partnership. Is it there? What are people expecting? What turns?
I think what you're already starting to see is the mantra that's being trotted out by Dick Parsons isn't one of synergy and isn't one of convergence of entertainment and technology, all the buzzwords of 2000, but it's more one of we want each division to be best in class. And this is almost something like General Electric would do with its far-flung divisions.
Each tub on its own bottom.
Right. And so they want everyone to perform to its profit goals, which kind of almost like the old fiefdom model. And you've got, you know, some very big divisions here, Warner Brothers Studios, Warner Music, HBO, CNN, under the cable networks, Time Inc. And he's now picked two of his most trusted lieutenants to essentially take over the day-to-day operations.
Nikhil Diogan, you're writing off the synergy idea, but it did seem in some sense to make sense. I mean, here's a lot of content here, new venues for bringing it to people, new ways to make it interactive. Was this a failure of the structure of this, or is it a failure of the structure of this partnership, or of the people who were tasked to carry out the melding?
I think a lot of it is the structure. I mean, we've seen time and again that these big mergers, which boast great synergies, it's not only AOL Time Warner. Look at Vivendi Universal, another melding of entertainment and technology where, you know, people predicted us watching movies and music on our wireless devices. You know, a lot of that promised convergence didn't happen. And I think you're seeing something similar there with the AOL Time Warner merger. You know, the big cross-platform advertising deals that were supposed to be the growth engine of this company. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were supposed to, if you were a big advertiser like General Motors, you were going to get, you know, sign a big cross-platform deal which would allow you to advertise everything from Sports Illustrated and People to America Online, mm-hmm. you know, to all its other divisions like CNN. And that essentially failed partly because of the corporate infighting. So yes, there is a lot of people element here too.
We can't help note that the two replacements, and they are two replacing Bob Pittman, are both from the Time Warner side of the company. Where does the founder of AOL and now chairman of AOL Time Warner, Steve Case, stand with Pittman's departure?
That's the great mystery. He has really been behind the scenes here. He lost his brother earlier this year to cancer, so obviously he's been distracted with that. How much of a factor he will be going forward is difficult to tell. Now, despite him and Bob Pittman being from the Old America Online, they always had some tense moments. So I don't think they were as strong allies as people may have perceived.
Nikhil Diogan, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
You're welcome, Tom.
Nikhil Diogan is the media and marketing editor at the Wall Street Journal. I believe in God, and I believe in free markets. That's what former Enron chairman Ken Lay told a San Diego reporter. And he's not alone. Since its beginnings, capitalism and the market forces that drive it have attracted an almost religious zeal from Ayn Rand to Ronald Reagan. The mighty market has inspired those who wish to worship. Markets, from the most basic to the most complex, operate all around us. From the camel bazaars of India to the global trade in AIDS drugs, people all over the world come together to buy, sell, invest, and trade. That basic market structure has been operating and evolving for thousands of years. Our guest tonight says the story of the markets is full of human ingenuity and advancing wealth, as well as excess, disappointment, and failure. Now, as America reassesses the market infatuation of Ronald Reagan in the roaring 90s, this economist reminds us that too much regulation means poverty, while too much free market can mean chaos. This hour, On Point, deconstructing the magic of the market. What makes markets work best? Has America followed free market ideology too far or not far enough? And is the market making us the best nation we can be? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from Palo Alto, California is John McMillan. He's professor of economics at Stanford University's Graduate School of Business and author of the new book, Reinventing the Bazaar, A Natural History of the Markets. Good evening and welcome, John McMillan.
Hi, Tom.
It's great to have you with us.
It's great to be here.
Also from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
John McMillan, you've written a wonderful book, much more riveting than any book on markets has any right to be. Enjoyed it enormously. You're an economist. You've had the whole buffet of subjects that come under an economist's purview to graze on. What has pulled you so deeply into tracking the evolution and current state of markets?
Well, markets are the key issue in the economy. The quote you started with from Kenneth Lay is a great introduction. I believe in God and I believe in free markets.
Right.
It's exactly, in my view, the wrong way to think about the economy, but it's one you hear quite a lot. And, of course, you often hear the opposite view as well. A lot of people think the market is Satan. Both misleading ways of thinking about it, it seems to me.
You've done a lot of homework over many years to come up with this book and with your thinking on it. Take us into some of your travels, into some of the markets, and right down to the bizarre level that you've seen that inform your view of what markets are and can be.
Well, there are markets, of course, everywhere. Markets are as old as civilization. One can learn a lot from studying markets as primitive, at least primitive on the face of it, as a third world bazaar, or as sophisticated as a stock market or the flower market in Aalsmeer, Holland, that I start the book with, which serves a big chunk of the world market in flowers, which is really quite remarkable when you think about it. Flowers are perishable things, and yet there is a central marketplace in Aalsmeer that serves the globe.
And they move $20 million worth of flowers a day, pulled in from all corners of the globe. As you sat or stood and watched that happen, what were you seeing? What did it tell you?
Well, it's fascinating. If you can imagine just flowers everywhere you see, in all directions, flowers in all their colors. It's a wonderfully graphic illustration of the power of markets.
And why do you call your book A Natural History of Markets? We don't associate economists with botany and nature.
Right. The analogy with biology is deliberate because a key theme in my book is that markets evolve. The market is not a static entity. It has to develop over time. People figure out new ways of trading. E-commerce is, of course, a very dramatic illustration of that. They're continually changing. They're a remarkably dynamic form of social organization.
But we get the sense from true believers that the invisible hand is a kind of timeless power that works in its mysterious way. If we would just sit back and let it go, everything would go like clockwork.
The invisible hand is remarkably powerful. We have to give its most enthusiastic advocates credit for observing that. It's an incredibly powerful force, but we shouldn't think of it as mysterious. It's not magical. It's not godlike. It's a human invention. It works as a result of human institutions, and it doesn't always work well.
You've pointed out that some thinkers have associated markets, though, with the hand of God because they seem to bring automatically a kind of rationality or reason into human affairs. Is that a fair observation?
Yeah, my position would be that they do bring a large amount of rationality and reason into human affairs, but they don't do it automatically. To see that, look at Russia in the 1990s. At the end of the Soviet Union, the government abruptly withdrew from controlling the economy under the view, presumably, that markets would spontaneously develop, that all you had to do to create a functioning market economy was get the government out. As is horribly obvious, when you look at the recent history of Russia, that didn't happen. Markets don't just happen of their own accord. They don't spring up magically. They take time. They require the actions of individuals and governments.
You've said that too much market freedom, too much kind of libertarian laissez-faire leads to perhaps Russia, or I think the country you cited was Somalia, which is, I guess, to say, if there's not some degree of regulation and government structure, you get something like chaos.
Exactly, yeah. No, you get something. Markets, to a limited extent, can work by themselves in a vacuum. Somalia has been, for the last 10 or so years, a country without a state. And despite its absence of a state, there is quite a lot of economic activity. There's lots of small firms. If you look around, there's booming activity. But it's not necessarily an efficient economy. It's a very poor economy. All sorts of public services are lacking. Garbage disposal, police, ports, and so on don't work well. That's sort of obvious. You don't get those sorts of things without government. More interestingly, I think, for the current discussion, firms tend to stay small. In order for firms to reach an efficient scale, you need some degree of government action in the background. Not government controlling things, not government picking winners, but government setting the platform for market activity, allowing financial markets to work, laws of contract, and so on.
But Jack Beattie, Ronald Reagan's mantra was, government is the problem. Markets, make way for markets.
Yeah, but as Herb Stein once said, Adam Smith did not wear an Adam Smith necktie. I'm looking at a page of things that Smith advocated government to do, from protecting the public against communicable diseases, to requiring clean streets, to imposing taxation, to discourage improper or luxurious behavior, putting ceilings on interest rates, on and on and on. So this notion of free markets in the name of Adam Smith would be a heresy to the great man himself, I think.
Well, we're going to be talking tonight with John McMillan about his book, Reinventing the Bazaar, and about the current state of the American embrace and handling of markets, not just the market on Wall Street, but all the markets that make up our lives, the market dynamic that for 20 years has been the core political message, the dominant political message of American political and economic life. The question is for you, has America followed the market ideology too far or not far enough? Do we see too much government intervention in the free market or not enough? Were you a rabid free marketeer in the 90s, and are you still? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about market economics and what we've learned after two decades of infatuation with the market as society's core organizing principle. Our guest tonight is John McMillan. He's professor of economics at Stanford University's Graduate School of Business. His latest book is Reinventing the Bazaar, A Natural History of Markets. You're welcome to the conversation as well. What do you think? Has America followed the free market ideology too far or not far enough? Does the invisible hand make miracles, or does it need help, guidance? And do we have the right balance of free market dynamics and political oversight in this country today or not? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. John McMillan, we want to get more of your stories and examples from around the world, but jump into the heart of the current issue with us for a minute here. How do you see, given everything you've looked at on markets and their evolution, how do you see the American relationship with the market dynamic today? Is it out of whack? Is it just about right? Are we radically off or just a little off? How would you appraise it?
I guess if you want a short answer, I'd say a little off. As you started out by saying, that the last decade of the 20th century, we could have described as the age of the market, mm-hmm. with the growth of electronic commerce, privatization in over 100 countries. Economists don't have a good track record at prediction, but let me venture a prediction. The first decade of the 21st century, we're going to see the pendulum swinging back. A little bit of retrenchment, a little bit of increased emphasis on the state as opposed to the market. We're already seeing it, by the way. Congress is figuring out all sorts of ways to re-regulate financial markets. The AIDS epidemic is running amok. Experts say that there needs to be a $10 billion annual fund donated mm-hmm. by governments in the name of public health, underline the word public. The visit to Africa by Bono and Treasury Secretary O'Neill mm-hmm. Underlined the plight of Africa, the horrible economic plight of Africa. Notice that this is not a failure of central planning. Government expenditure in sub-Saharan Africa averages about 25% of national income, which means that three-quarters of economic activity in those African countries is covered by markets, evidently. Markets aren't doing what they're supposed to be doing in Africa.
Well, stick with this for us. You listened with the rest of us as we were instructed for the last decade and more that if government hand just got out of things, the market would make them much better. And an awful lot of people put a lot of stock in that and continue to today. I think there's something that Americans really resonate with in that message. What can't the market do? Have we learned something about the things that it can't take care of?
Well, yes, I think we have. But let me say that in a lot of cases, that prescription was the right one. Mm-hmm. It's very much a case-by-case thing. All that I'm saying is that markets can't do everything. Often we see excessive government regulation, and it's appropriate to pull back. Sometimes there needs to be a state role in order for governments to do what they're supposed to do. And this sort of pendulum swinging, I think, is normal. Think of the 1920s versus the 1930s. In a sense, it's the same kind of thing. The market-oriented 20s were followed by an increase in the role of the government in the 30s. The right mix of government and market is very hard to get right. It's a subtle thing and sometimes is overshooting, inevitably, in an imperfect world. And therefore, there's a need to correct the overshooting. This pendulum isn't necessarily a bad thing.
But if we look at the pendulum and think of physics, every action brings an equal and opposite reaction. It's hard to imagine a reaction to the 90s that takes us as far into government regulation as the 90s took us into the market dynamic.
No, of course, and it shouldn't. A lot of what happened in the 90s should have happened. It's just that in a few cases, things may have gone a little too far.
Jack Beattie, excuse me, I'm sorry.
No, go on. Yeah.
Well, I just wanted to ask Jack to respond to your notion that we're marginally off of true market optimal state here, and what we're likely to see is tweaking out of Congress in the decade ahead.
Yeah, I don't know that globalization would give us margin to do anything else. I mean, I think that all government regulation now, for better and in my view, often for worse, is under the pressure, under the necessity of globalization, of the equalization of trade between nations and the relentless, ubiquitous pressure to make everything more efficient and to be competitive. And all government regulation has to come flat up against that. So, yes, we're going to tip back, but I don't expect we're going to see labor law reform that would make it easier to have people join unions. I don't expect we're going to see, more equitable taxation. That there'll be a limit, in short, dictated by the sort of mock environment of a globalizing economy.
And there is the market uber alles, at least to some extent. John McMillan, you leave your readers with a kind of prescription for the surround that makes markets work most effectively. Can you share those elements that you've described, that you've come to the conclusion are necessary for markets to do their best?
Well, two key words are information and trust. These things are left out of some of the simpler accounts of economics. And by the way, my motivation for writing the book is a recognition that on the one hand, we have economics as it's presented in undergraduate textbooks and in the public debate. On the other hand, we have economics as it's understood in academic research. And that's what I tried to get across in the book, a richer notion of markets that recognizes that markets operate in an environment where information is unevenly distributed, and that affects the way markets work and sometimes makes them work badly. And there need to be institutions and rules and procedures that recognize that information can create market frictions, can make markets work badly. Markets also need trust, as is glaringly obvious in the light of the current scandals. When trust breaks down, markets don't work well. But it's quite a subtle matter to set up mechanisms that ensure people behave in a trustworthy manner.
Mm-hmm. And beyond those, you've got several more points. One interesting one is you say, if I get this right, markets should not impose undue costs on people outside the market activity.
Yes. An important feature that's left out of some of the more religious views of markets is what economists call externalities. That is, third-party effects, costs or benefits imposed on people not involved in the initial decision, not involved in the market transaction in question, things like pollution. In the textbooks, these come in the last or second last chapter. They're discussed as an afterthought. In reality, they're pretty pervasive. When you drive your car in the morning, you're contributing to traffic congestion. You're creating an externality that affects others.
So when you look at the 90s, what externalities jump out at you? What, while the market was making efficiency and productivity rise and a bunch of people wealthy, what cost was it ringing up?
You could say that some of these financial market scandals represent externalities, that there are insider and outsider shareholders, and the activities of the insiders impose an externality on the activity on the well-being of the outsiders. Mm-hmm. That's one way of interpreting the current scandals. There is an additional caveat to the notion that markets work well beyond externalities that I think is more relevant to the 90s, which is the notion of income distribution and equity. This is a relevant consideration in evaluating the economy. It's not something that economists have any particular ability to speak about beyond anybody else's ability to speak about, but it is an important consideration, one that you can't just leave to the market.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Professor John McMillan. His book is Reinventing the Bazaar, A Natural History of Markets. He's all for the market, but he says you've got to get the balance right, and evolution is taking place in our understanding of markets. What do you think? Have we got markets about right? What kind of human society does the market create? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Michael's on the line. Welcome, Michael. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I've often thought that capitalism, which is more than just the free market, it's a whole social system built around it, including things like greater respect for richer people and poorer people, but that it should be likened to any other sort of technology. And you have to, it's good for some things like information flow. People have strong incentive to find out as much as possible about what's selling on the other side of the world. But it's a set of rewards and punishments, and it's like any other technology. It has its good sides, it has its bad sides, it has its limits, and that just, for example, as we want an adequate engine in a car. We don't want a car that's all engine.
So you're looking at the market or the market dynamic as a technology.
Yes, that it does certain things, and it does some of them very well. On the other hand, it has the capability of being what some people call a totalizing metaphor. The question is, do we want our entire lives to be market-driven?
Mm-hmm. This is what's, Michael, thank you for that observation and the call. John McMillan, this is what seems to be in a lot of people's minds as life has sped up, as competition has globalized, as the demands of people's jobs seem to have crept into more corners of their lives, is what does it mean to commit ourselves so thoroughly, it sometimes seems, to the dictate of the market? Does it create a humane life?
I don't see that as a huge issue. I'm not sure it dictates anything. I mean, the essence of the market is freedom of choice. If you want to opt out, you can.
But can you really? So, once the dynamic sets in globally and we're in competition with everyone and everything is measured down to the last nanosecond and a milliliter.
Well, you can go live in Arizona. You know, you could go live in Fiji. There are ways out. To repeat, the essence of the market is choice. But I certainly agree with Michael. I entirely agree. The market does some things well, some things badly. It's a matter of recognizing which is which. And I would add an additional caveat that it doesn't work by itself, but it needs help. It needs, it doesn't automatically do the things that it's supposed to do.
Do you agree with the notion that the market its impact is seeping into more corners of life than it's historically occupied, and that we are more surrounded and embraced by the dynamic of the market than our forebears?
That's very hard to say. It impacts us in many different ways than it did our forebears, but our forebears operated under the spell of markets as well. In some ways, more so, to the extent that they were poorer, they were more at the market's dictate than we are now in our relatively affluent state.
Paul's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Welcome, Paul. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to mention Ted Fishman's wonderful article in this month's Harper's called Making a Killing, The Myth of Capital's Good Intentions, in which he chronicles the markets and corporations' profits from civil wars all around the world. And he mentions Sudan, and I guess that the government for a while was considering a law which would have banned companies from doing business with companies in Sudan.
So how does he describe markets as fueling civil war?
Well,
just buying diamonds from this party or that?
Yeah, the diamond trade is one. The oil trade in Sudan is another of rebel armies being paid to attack the oil wells, and often these are children or teens, and human life is very cheap, and the civil wars are kept going for the business of drilling oil.
John McMillan, what does this bring to mind? Are we looking here at the limits of in the capacity of some governments to govern the wilder edges of market effects?
Yeah, perhaps, although I'd prefer to think of markets as being amoral rather than immoral. Certainly people will make a buck if they can out of all kinds of situations, but preventing the kinds of activities complained about, I think, is the role of the state. We should just accept that if there's money to be made, somebody's going to make it. If we want to prevent that happening, we should employ the role of the power of the state. Sometimes that's going to be difficult. But laying the blame on markets, I don't think, is very helpful in this particular case. Again, the alternative way to think about it is this is another instance of the limits of markets. This is,
that there's some things that they just won't take care of. Harold is on the line. Welcome, Harold. You're on the air.
Yeah, I'd like to address the fundamental premise you fellows have, which is that there's less or too little government control in the 90s. What struck me with Enron, Arthur Andersen, and the group was the tax laws, which created stock options and abilities to manipulate the numbers. And they are all basically fundamentally driven by tax policies, which allowed people to put money in their pocket by following those rules.
So, Harold, you see too much government structure creating opportunities to manipulate markets in an impure way.
Yes, basically, when any set of rules become highly complicated, then they do get moved in an amoral way. Chess is amoral; it's just a game.
Mm-hmm.
And by creating such highly complex tax policies, the government, I think, had to do one of two things. Either then create another set of highly complex rules to govern the consequences of the tax policies, or make the tax policy simple. I mean, one of the things they're saying about Enron and all those people is, after me the deluge, just Louis Couture's. But if they're going to do that, they could just say, well, no stock option of an executive could be exercised.
Harold, I'll put that to John McMillan, but I guess I want to ask the other question, then, is do you buy the whole notion that the 90s was a time when the free market had much more reign, that it was the kind of reigning view of the world and how things ought to work?
No, I think that business had more ability to maneuver, but I don't call that a free market.
Interesting.
The market got less free.
John McMillan, what about Harold's observation that we live in a world in the United States of lots of government structure, intervention, and regulation that actually warps the way he might like to see the things to work?
Undoubtedly, governments behave in all kinds of ways that they shouldn't. Complex tax policies certainly create the possibility for all kinds of shenanigans. It's hard to argue, I think, though, that the tax laws are the fundamental reason for Enron and WorldCom. Greed is there regardless of what the tax laws look like.
Jim is calling from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Hello. Hi. How you doing?
Real well, thanks.
I worked over 40 years in very heavy industry,
mm-hmm.
and the foundry industry. And I have seen in the last 10 years especially that everything is just moving offshore. The whole manufacturing sector is just leaving the United States.
So you've seen a lot of globalization.
Yes, a tremendous amount. And, all you need to do is go in and buy something in the store and take a look at it and say, well, it was made in China and it was $5. If it was made here, it cost $20.
So what question arises out of that in your mind?
Well, I think that what's happening, what are we going to do with our my basic point is that if we don't make things and if we don't grow things, our society's going to just die. And I don't see where – I don't care about government regulation. For example, the tariff in the steel business. That isn't going to work. It might work for a while, but sooner or later, it's not going to work. So we can't compete in manufacturing with the rest of the world, and I think it's going to really have a terrible detrimental effect on our way of life here. But there are thousands and thousands of people that get laid off or,
mm-hmm.
or fired when these companies merge and when.
We've got it. Jim, we hear you loud and clear, and I thank you for the call. We're going to hold John McMillan's answer until after the break, but we'll get right to it. We're talking about market economics and what we've learned. Has the market worked for you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about market economics and what we've learned from thousands of years of living in the market, from the last decade of living in the market. Our guest tonight is John McMillan. His latest book is Reinventing the Bazaar, A Natural History of Markets. You can join the conversation. What do you think? Do we have the right balance of free market dynamics and political oversight in the United States today? We're at 1-800-423-8255. John McMillan, just before the break, our caller Jim was looking at the industry he's seen go abroad and say, gosh, the market looks like it's hollowing out the country that I know. What do you say to that?
Well, Jim said we the U.S. can't compete in manufacturing. I would qualify that to say we can't compete in labor-intensive manufacturing.
Mm-hmm.
We can't compete with low-wage countries in activities that use a lot of labor. A healthy economy has a lot of flux. One of the chief virtues of the market economy is its flexibility. Firms are being born and firms are dying at an astonishing rate when you look at the data. And that happens within the country. It also happens internationally. Industries, lines of activities move from country to country, depending on economic conditions. This is essential. That kind of flexibility is what makes the market economy efficient. It's not a new phenomenon. It's been going on as long as the United States has existed. The hollowing out hasn't happened yet, and I don't think it's going to happen in the foreseeable future.
There's always something coming in behind.
Exactly.
And yet, Jack Beatty, it's hard to listen to the pain and the yelps of the people who are affected by that wonderful flux.
Yes, and here's where the market comes into conflict with democracy. They operate on different principles. And at a certain point, societies say to themselves, how much are we sacrificing of our social substance, of our equality, of our livelihoods to efficiency? And then they make other decisions. And sometimes those decisions are rash, protectionism, and sometimes they're, you know, they involve retraining. And but if you just say the market and don't look at the picture of its human effects, then democracy says, no, you can't do that. The steelworkers say to Bush, we're not going to vote for you in the next election. And they get protected. And what they're reflecting is a real thing. We don't exist for the sake of the market. The market exists for the sake of us.
I want to put that to our guest, but we've got a caller who's speaking to a similar issue, I think. Jose is on the line. Welcome, Jose. You're on the air.
Hey, yeah. Good evening, everybody.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
It's exactly my point. As human beings, we don't live for the market. The market has to sell human beings, but we have been living lately in the late 90s in excesses of free market where really the big corporations have been doing whatever they want. And really, what is the role of society? Society is the most important, and I don't think that we have to sacrifice democracy and a lot of social benefits that has been won during a lot of generations just because the corporations want to get more profits.
Mm-hmm. Jose, thanks for your call. Between you and Jack, we've set up the question here. I guess John McMillan, Jack is worried that at some point the market is in conflict with democracy. Jose says, what about this sense that we have that there are excesses here that raise inhuman demands on people?
Yeah, I don't think I disagree with either speaker. I think it's entirely appropriate for the democratic processes to look at what the market is doing and make an evaluation of it. The flux and flexibility that I was praising before certainly has a downside. Some people are hurt by it. I'm not sure we should totally blame the market for that. I think this illustrates the limits of the market. There is a role for the government to step in to provide some sort of social insurance to protect those who are hurt by changes, market-based changes. In fact, the United States does recognize this. There is something called trade adjustment assistance, which provides retraining and special grants for workers whose jobs are destroyed by trade, by international trade. Now, this assistance happens to be pretty miserly, but the principle is recognized in U.S. law that it's the government's role to protect those hurt by the market.
But when you see and read and hear people complaining about the impact of globalization, about the imposition of ever greater demands for efficiency that Jack Beatty talks to, what crosses your mind? You've looked at markets all over the place. Are we just crybabies right now? Are we just for some reason, you know, not up to the market demands that generations have faced before us? Or is there something different happening here?
I don't think it's different from the past. The Luddites made the same complaints. You know, this is a continuing complaint, and it's a valid complaint. One thing that I think has to be borne in mind is that there is something on the other side of the ledger that globalization properly managed, and it hasn't always achieved this, but properly managed, is an impetus to economic growth. And economic growth, the data clearly show, is good for the poor. That is, the people at the bottom end of the income distribution see their incomes rise at the same rate as the rest of the economy on average when the economy grows. This is true across countries.
It sounds as though you see it all as is in within the arc of the pendulum. What's your expectation? Is the reaction to the 90s that we see underway now going to swing too far? Are we going to crimp the market in a way that hurts prosperity in the United States?
Well, who knows? As I said before, economists have a terrible track record at forecasting, but I'm not overly concerned about that. I think what Jack said before is correct, that the more open economy that we now see imposes some constraints on what the government can do and prevents the more egregious kinds of interventions.
John McMillan, you've written a wonderful book, and we thank you for coming on and talking with us about it. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you very much.
John McMillan has written Reinventing the Bazaar, A Natural History of Markets. Jack Beattie, we've got just 10 or 20 seconds here, but it sounds like we're lashed into this thing and for the good on the more wealth side, but also for the downturn.
Yeah, and you know, market societies are in the grip of forces that have a life of their own. I mean, we make the market, but in a strange way, it also makes us. It drives us. It's surrendering a lot, but that's life, I guess.
That's where we are. Jack, thanks for being with us tonight. Listeners, you can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, the Emmy nominations are announced, and 6 Feet Under buries the competition. This is On Point. Early this morning, the nominees for the 54th Emmy Awards were announced. Leading the pack with 23 nominations was the new HBO funeral family soap opera, 6 Feet Under.
You know, we have the independent funeral director's lunch today, right?
Man, why do I have to go? That's your thing.
It's your thing, too, now. These are your colleagues. It's important to know who they are.
I know who they are. I met them in Vegas. They're freaks.
They're not freaks. Not the local guys.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure the L.A. morticians are a lot more fun than the guys from Montana.
You're an L.A. mortician now, Nate. This is your community.
You know, it's polite for the first person downstairs to make the coffee, even if that person has a penis.
Well, you know, it's also polite for the first person who uses the bathroom to spend less than 45 minutes in there, even if that person has a vulva.
This year, HBO led all networks with a total of 93 nominations. Other big Emmy nomination grabbers were West Wing, Sex and the City, and Will and Grace. While past powerhouses, Frasier and ER, barely registered. To go through the big winners, losers, and surprises, we're joined by Bob Thompson, the director of the Center for the Study of Popular Television at Syracuse University. Welcome, Bob Thompson.
Thank you.
Bob, the buzz today is how, once again, HBO shows, cable shows, are dominating the Emmy nominations, and especially the new show 6 Feet Under. What about this show is making the Academy say, here we go?
Well, you know, it is funny. Here's a show with 23 nominations, more than anything else, and most of America has never seen this program before. I think the reason it's getting nominated and the reason that HBO is getting all these nominations across the board is that HBO is far and away the most exciting place in American television right now from an artistic standpoint, and it has been for probably 5, almost 10 years now. The reason HBO can do this stuff is that it has to play by totally different rules. HBO, for one thing, could care less what the ratings of its shows are. They simply depend that people like what they give enough to continue their subscriptions and that more people start subscribing. And you can bet after today and all the buzz they're getting for this show, their subscription rate is going to go soaring.
But does that mean, would you agree that quality has migrated away from broadcast television?
Absolutely. The test kitchens of innovation is all in cable now for some of the goofy stuff over on basic cable, South Park, The Daily Show, all this early reality stuff, and the real high-quality, highbrow stuff over on pay cable. None of the real excitement right now is happening on network TV. It isn't to say that they don't have some good shows, and some of those were nominated as well.
Noticeably absent this year, another cable show, The Sopranos.
Right. The Sopranos is not on there because, believe it or not, The Sopranos has not had a new episode in over 1 year. Not a single one of their episodes falls into the category for this Emmy period.
Another peculiarity of the cable era that shows as big as that can go for a whole year without new shows in broadcast, that's unimaginable.
It absolutely is. And, you know, I think it's one of the advantages, too. It gives us a little time to detox. I mean, these other shows, it's not so much the quality, but the quantity that ultimately brings them down. The Sopranos was just about to that point where I think it was risking overexposure, a little bit of backlash, and like any good mob boss, it disappeared for a while.
On the comedy side, last year's big winner was another HBO show, Sex in the City.
3 innings, 4 beers, and 1 shameless flash of my press pass later, we waited outside the locker room to get my ball signed by the new Yankee.
Hi, good game.
Did you see that bolt?
He was wearing a cup.
Well, honey, his cup runneth over.
Sex and the City with fewer nominations this year than last, but it's still a popular show. Bob Thompson, what's the buzz on this show this year? Is it losing its special touch?
Yeah, I think Sex and the City has peaked and it's beginning to come down a little bit. And part of it is that the fantasy it presents, these people at a certain point in their life, totally independent, in the city and all the rest of it, eventually has to end someplace. And as characters now are beginning to have pregnancies and all of the rest of it, this show is having the same thing happen to it that happens to every program that stays on for a long time, is it just simply wears out. Unless you're a cartoon like The Simpsons, things change. My formula is that we can now measure TV series in double dog years. 14 years per 1 year just about says it.
And maybe post 9/11, this kind of lighter-than-air life in New York just didn't seem in touch with much of anything anymore.
Well, you know, I thought that this wouldn't play at all right after that happened. I didn't know that you could do comedy at all in New York, but it is amazing how quickly the entertainment industrial complex started pouring its digestive juices upon September 11th, and this actually played pretty well. I believe all the shows that aired this season had been shot prior to September 11th. These will be the first ones we see this coming season that actually were conceived after that event.
Oh, how fast we electronically heal. For the non-HBO dramas, West Wing was second in nominations with 21.
Guess what?
What?
Our goal is to proclaim American values.
This speech isn't supposed to be about ideology. It's supposed to be about reality.
I think the president will decide what the speech is supposed to be about, but the reality is the United States of America no longer sucks up to reactionaries, and our staunch allies will know what we mean.
We don't have any staunch allies in the Arab world, just reluctant ones. We have a coalition held together with duct tape. A coalition without which we cannot fight.
Nobody's blowing off the coalition, and that coalition will be plenty strong.
But when we win?
That's right.
What's Egypt going to think? Or Pakistan?
That freedom and democracy are coming soon to a theater near them, so get dressed.
They were a big winner last year, West Wing. Bob Thompson, has a new administration and a war on terror affected this show? Is it still the powerhouse it was? Is it heavier-handed, maybe?
Well, it's still cruising along. I mean, everybody thought when this was no longer sort of the parallel universe Democratic administration, but something completely different from what we have in the White House, that would be a problem. Some thought it would be impossible to do a White House program after September 11th without incorporating contemporary stories. I think it's actually managed pretty well. Heavy-handed, though, may be a good word. This thing is always on the verge of getting too preachy. It's all about the Jeremiad of the week that the president finally comes out and says, and so far, it's always kept on the very entertaining end of that. In many ways, I think West Wing is a perfect example of what network television does well. It can't do the funeral industry. It certainly can't do the New Jersey mob. It can't do maximum security prisons. It can't do single women in New York. West Wing is one of those things that doesn't try to be doing what HBO is doing. It does what it's good at. And it, too, will wear out before long, but one hopes that the standards it set will be the ones that other 10 o'clock dramas will follow.
Your quick take, Bob Thompson, on the direction and quality of American television this year. How's it doing?
Well, I think the amount of really fine television is higher now than it's ever been before, including in the so-called golden age of the 50s. On the other hand, the amount of really horrible, trashy, terrible cheeseball television is also higher than it's ever been. The fact remains, the big trend in television is there's just plain more of everything.
And why do we still love radio? Bob Thompson, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Bob Thompson is director of the Center for the Study of Popular Television at Syracuse. On Point is produced by Micheline Boudreau, Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog. With help from Courtney Barth, Sabi Mir, Tina Toby, and Michael Garth. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WB.